the sort of five. We're going to start with the sort of five-minute getting some ideas and interesting issues on the table. Very different groups and sorts of people to provide their perspective. Then we will be passing through three of the coordinators. So what we have is Phil Lubin, Carlo Cantaldi, and Andre Froloff to give a little bit of their perspectives. Then I'll do my usual three-hour talk, and all within 5 minutes. And then Matthias will have a few comments, then Eva, and then hopefully we will have a free-for-all where we will simultaneously solve all problems left in the background. Our illustrious chair, who will be guiding us through this, is Steve Schenker.
My job is to hand the microphone to Dick. That microphone.
And my job is to hand it to Phil Lubin. Okay. So I asked Phil, as one of the, he may not look it, but he's one of the senior people in the microwave background, to give his perspective as a Planckian, but also just having had a very vast sweep of the subject. So
thank you, Dick. You handed, your job is done. Thank you. So just to, yes. 5 minutes. Okay, so I learned very early on two things. I started out as a field theorist, and then I met Dick Bond. Okay, when I met Dick Bond, I realized that one can put on one slide all of reality and then have 10 slides per second and have an amazing slideshow. So I learned this very early on. So I have about 100 slides to show you in 5 minutes. Okay, first part is predicting the future is somewhat more difficult than the past. But what I thought I'd just talk to you briefly about is possibilities. First of all, the number of species is not three, okay? It's four. First of all, sometimes Planck is called the third generation experiment, and that's not true. There was a one before COBE, which was the Russian relic one. So while we are often lost in the Western view of reality, there was one before. And while they are very quiet, and somehow got subsumed by geopolitical considerations, they did actually quite a spectacular job, and in some ways had detections about the same time as COBE, although they had a budget which was probably about equal to the coffee budget on Planck, maybe, probably less than that. So first of all, I wanted to draw attention to a few things. It's going to be a little bit of a romp through what's possible to do, partly from orbital and partly from the ground and balloons, since those are the three choices we have at the moment. No one's proposed an extragalactic mission yet, though that would be nice. So the Planck sensitivity in the 143 gigahertz channel is about 17 microkelvin in a second, which is a combination of 11 detectors. So this turns out to be roughly around 60 microkelvin per second per detector. So by comparison, this will be important when you start talking about thousands of detectors on the ground versus thousands of detectors in space. This makes a huge difference because the amount of time it takes goes as the inverse square of the sensitivity. Well, it goes as a square. Okay, here's a historical view of sensitivity on detectors. This is in noise equivalent power, so watts per hertz is a function of year. And it's such a great plot. Jonas put this together based on a lot of historical data. And there's a kind of an interesting scaling law here, that the change in the log, in this case base 2 of the NEP over time, is, you know, is scaling as a power law. But this has kind of a, you know, a Moore's law-like view to it. But in fact, there's something which is in the second part. Reality actually intervenes when you say, what do you want to do with these things? So this is the sensitivity of your detector. And since the time to get to a given measurement signal goes as the, effectively is the inverse square. If you change by, say, 10 orders of magnitude from 10 to the minus 9 to 10 to the minus 19, you just change your integration time by a factor of 10 to the 20. And 10 to the 20 is a large number for those of you that still use a HP calculator, like I do occasionally. Okay. So there are many things out there to be concerned about. So if you're inside the atmosphere, you have to worry about the atmosphere, and this is the equivalent noise equivalent power as a function of frequency now in terahertz. So the CMB bands are typically down here, but Planck goes all the way up to close to 1 terahertz. So this is the atmosphere from probably one of the best places on Earth, which is Dome A in Antarctica, which is significantly better than any of the northern or southern mid-latitude sites, and quite a bit better than the South Pole. It's not as good as a balloon or obviously being in space. In addition to that, you have other issues to worry about. You have the emission from the mirror, which also adds its own photon noise. And then you have the CMB itself. And then you have various things like the cosmic infrared background and the galaxy, and then ultimately zodiacal light to worry about. So this is kind of a broad scale overview of what you worry about. And here I've shown as a function of mirror temperature and as a function of another atmospheric contribution, in this case, from a balloon at 40 kilometers. So you see the structure here may not look at first much different than this, but it's actually dramatically different. Okay, and again, your time goes like the square of this, so factors of 10 equate to factors of 100 in time. This is comparing various missions and sites. So this is an orbital mission, SPICA, versus CCAT, which is an upcoming millimeter, submillimeter experiment from Chile versus a hypothetical one at Dome A versus something in the equivalent of Mauna Kea, but in California we have a peak which is about the same altitude called White Mountain versus two balloon systems, one where the optics are at 230K in red and one where it's at 2K. If you notice here, look at how low the atmosphere becomes when you actually have cold optics. And this becomes very important for some missions for the future. And here I've done the same thing, but I've changed the resolution from a factor of 1,000 to a factor of 10. Okay, but anyway, let's go on. If you look at the transmission of the atmosphere, since most of the missions in the next decade are going to be ground-based missions or balloon-borne, this becomes very important to understand the transmission of the atmosphere. Again, this is a function of frequency. It's 100 gigahertz. Here's 1 terahertz. So Planck goes from a bit below 0.1 up to about 1. And from the ground, you can see there are certain windows which have reasonable transmission, well, which is shown here in the linear scale. And again, going from Dome A, Santa Barbara on a dry day, if you close the bars early, actually is as good as any place on Earth. Essentially, it's as good as Dome A. But getting a dry day in Santa Barbara is kind of like buying liquor on Sunday in Texas when I used to hang out there for ballooning. It's just not going to happen. Okay, South Pole is shown in green. Chanchinantar in Chile is shown in blue. Mauna Kea White Mountain shown in black. And then this is probably what it looks like today in Santa Barbara. But what you notice is that there are certain windows which, when you go to reasonable sites, open up very well in the typical CMB bands. This is the 140 gigahertz window. This is up around 220, 250 gigahertz. And then, you know, it just goes to pot. And so if you want to do a mission where you want to look out, say, at the 857 band on Planck, you're going to have an extremely difficult time. Not impossible, but it becomes extraordinarily difficult. Okay, here's a map which one of our graduate students just submitted as a paper, which will come out shortly. This is a worldwide view of the entire globe in terms of the precipitable water vapor. So the reason this is important is that most of the absorption bands that you worry about in seeing through the atmosphere are due to water vapor transitions. So this goes from 0 to 25. This is effectively saturated air at sea level. So as you can see, in the mid-latitudes, over much of the Earth, you're completely dominated by a nearly saturated atmosphere. But at the extremes, in the south and in the north, and in certain high-altitude sites, you know, you can see the Argentina, the Andes, Chile here. You can see parts of Tibet here, Himalayas, parts of the United States, and then parts of Alaska, et cetera. Okay, so there's certain regions which are good, but most of them are not very good. When you go to the extremes, then it becomes much better. So this will be published, hopefully, in the next couple of months. It's been submitted. Okay, if you zoom in, if you want to go to Antarctica, 1 minute left. Yeah, okay, well, that's a suggestion. Okay. So here's the South Pole. Here's Dome C, Dome A, Dome F. Okay, and here it's now from 0 to 1 millimeter. Okay, so it's much, much better. Oops, wrong way. Sorry about that. Here's cloud cover shown. Okay, so certain parts of the world are cloudier than others. Again, the mid-latitude sites tend to be quite cloudy, although in parts of Africa and the United States and Chile, not bad. Again, Antarctica is very good. Okay, this is just showing the medium transmission, which is probably not that important. If you go to a balloon, on the other hand, the situation changes dramatically. This is transmission now as a function of frequency. This is the, there's a band here at 30 kilometers and one at 40 kilometers. You effectively have near 99.something% transmission over the CMB bands. Okay, so the bottom line. currently, the state of the art from the ground is about 500 microkelvin per root second per detector from the ground, being an excellent site. You go up on a balloon, you can go about a factor of 2, maybe 3, if you're lucky. If you go into space, you can get even lower, particularly if you cool the optics a bit. Okay, so notice that these are about a factor of 10 difference, which means in order to have the equivalent sensitivity in the ground, you need a factor of 10 squared more detectors, so 100. So one detector in space is worth 100 on the ground at a frequency which is good, like 143. At 857, the comparison would be probably more like 1,000,000 to 1. Okay, how to do better? Well, you just have to have more detectors because there's no more Moore's law going on here. We've effectively hit the photon limit. Throughput, you can add more modes, but all you do there is sacrifice resolution. And sensitivity is just going to go like the squared number of detectors. Okay, one thing I just want to point out and go back and then I'm done. So if you look at the mapping speed difference between what we had on COBE, which is sort of comparable to RELIC, a little bit better than RELIC, we have about a factor of 1,000 sensitivity and a million in mapping speed. So the difference between Planck and COBE is about 1,000,000 to 1. So it takes 1,000,000 years of COBE for 1 year of Planck, assuming they have the same beam size, which of course they don't. And the difference between Planck and WMAP is about 1,000 to 1. So 1 year on Planck is approximately equal to 1,000 years on WMAP if they had the same beam size, which they don't. Okay, so these are dramatic differences over a period while I've been involved. So 1,000,000 to 1 in mapping speed, which is truly incredible. But that difference now is going to taper off. Okay, done.
So is WMAP to COBE really a factor of 1,000? I mean, I know.
The mapping speed is square. So in COBE, our best channel was around. Okay, so on COBE, when I first started working on COBE, which was 1977, I guess it was, we were going to use warm detectors. And then I went off, was doing some work, and we ended up using cold detectors based on some balloon-borne work we were doing. So we ended up using cold detectors, which is good, because otherwise we probably wouldn't have found what we found in 92. But the best detectors we had were a factor of 30 worse than on WMAP.
No, but if you simply compare, you know, we have like 1 year of Planck and 8 years of WMAP, and on large scales, when the BMAPs, they're not that.
Right, so
well,
why, yeah.
I mean,
that's,
you know,
so,
there are all the sample variance and so on.
No, no, that's, well, that's, they don't, that's the difference. So how many pixels do you have on WMAP? So it's there's a combination of beam size and sensitivity. WMAP, the sensitivity, was in the order of millikelvin root seconds. You could do the math in your head. On Planck, the sensitivity was 17 microkelvin root seconds. It's a factor of 50 greater. So you add in a few things here and there. You know, 1,000 to 1 is sort of conservative, but that's the correct number to use. You know, it's 1 year is 1,000 if they had the same beam size, which they don't. Right, so that, yeah, so in space, what you'd love to do is have, I mean, kilopixels are viable, and a megapixel may be viable, but not in the immediate future, but that's longer term, I could see that, maybe after I die. But thousands of detectors are certainly very viable in space. Getting them into space and getting a mission approved and living long enough to see it happen, I'm not so sanguine about that point.
Well, the next generation might be maybe not 1,000, but maybe 100 times detectors. I mean, the thing that we've been proposing in Europe is in the 5,000 detectors range, not 50,000, which would be, you know, multiplying by 1,000. There are 50 detectors, 50 polymers on HFI. So.
Correct, right. So if you increase that by a factor of 100, then you could get to 10 times lower sensitivity. It's only going down now by the square root of the number of detectors, since you're at the photon limit.
Well, in the ballpark, it's understood, because, I mean, it's going from 60 micro-k arc minute, and 10 times lower, it's 6 micro-k arc minute, and this is the level of lensing from the B modes from lensing. And this is, and that's typically saying the kind of thing that we might be able to do is that.
Yeah, so the reason I showed so much detail, which most people probably weren't interested except the pretty pictures of the Earth, is that if you compare ground to balloon to air, you gain roughly a factor of 10 in sensitivity, which means you get a factor of 100 in mapping speed from going good ground, say South Pole or Chile, to space in these frequencies. If you go into the submillimeter, it's much more dramatic than that, you know, easily millions to one. Okay, but in the really good bands, it's only factors of 10 in sensitivity or 100 in mapping speed. When you go up into the balloon altitudes, then that difference only becomes a factor of, say, 2 to 3. So the difference between a balloon in, again, good bands in space is a factor of 2 to 3 in sensitivity, which means you only gain a factor of 4 to 10 in mapping speed. And then it becomes a question. You know, this is, as you know, a very hotly contested discussion. I know you don't.
So before we move on, I'll have one other question for you, which is that Firas the Great and Gush the Great and BAM, which was the anisotropy experiment that used Fourier transform spectrometry, is a very interesting approach, and that's of course being proposed for the PIXI satellite experiment. Right. What are your thoughts on that and pitfalls, etc.? Is that going to be the next big thing?
So I think there's some underappreciated heroes in this whole thing, and Gush is certainly one of them. If anyone knows about the history of this, the beautiful work that was done prior and contemporary with Firas from suborbital rocket flights, which is spectacular, as was why I put up the Russian work. I think there was a heroic effort to try to get something. The Firas detectors were in the range of 10 to minus 15 watts per hertz, a little bit better than that in some cases. But it's now possible to hit the photon limit, which is for modest bands is around 10 to minus 17, 10 to minus 18. It depends on the resolution. Push it down 10 to minus 19 for a higher R. So I'm very excited about the possibility of having a next generation FIRAS, which will allow us to place limits on many things, which would be much more exciting than what we have now. Getting that into space is a real problem. And that is a mission which is not well suited to a balloon. problem, unfortunately. So it's a political problem. If we could just go out and put in space tomorrow, that absolutely would be one of the highest priorities I could imagine. But the reality is a lot tougher now.
Okay, that doesn't mean that's the end of discussion of futures in terms of experiment, but and now for something completely different. Carlo is going to tell us something interesting.
Thanks. I didn't really know what the remit here was, but I just wanted to mention a few things on non-Gaussianity from theoretical and from a fun point of view. The first one is just for the benefit of observers, we've heard a lot about how FNL from single field inflation is unobservably small in all cases. You could walk away with the wrong impression here. So I'm just pointing out a couple of pretty plots from some recent work I've done, which is to do with randomly generating inflationary trajectories. This is something that's been done often, and you may have already seen a plot like this, R versus an S, and you've got this random scatter of trajectories generated in various ways. This is just the Hamilton-Jacobi formalism here. This is, of course, where this is the money shot we've been looking at all week, this is the equivalent plot in FNL versus NS, and this just shows for equilateral FNL, which we haven't heard much about, that in the slow roll limit, indeed, it's very small, virtually unobservable, and it's actually we reproduce the nice slow roll limit in that case. But you can open up things, and if you take in particular non-slow roll limit, in this case for equilateral FNL, or non-canonical kinetic terms, then you can get much larger FNLs, and this was just something we put in the paper as a proof of concept, CS smaller than 1. So in FNL and NS, you can see that you get pretty large values. There's a horrible parameter that people have suggested in terms of a running of an FNL. That's a terrible parameter to parameterize a scale or scale dependence of FNL because FNL tends to be very, very flat or have lots of structure on it, i.e. wiggles, which is just what you're seeing here. But I like this plot because it looks like a phi, and therefore it can't be wrong because it's to do with single field inflation. Okay, so that's just one thing. It's more for observers just to keep your point of view open. I've just added the Planck error bars there roughly because this, Yes?
I'm sure it's a dumb question, but You're saying the kinetic terms are non-canonical and yet it's slow roll. What do you mean by that exactly?
This case here, what we've done is we kept a constant CS just for simplicity, and the trajectories that you see here actually end up being in the, call them what you want, Hubble slow roll, eta and epsilon, they're actually small. Okay, so...
Well, so certainly anytime you have inflation overall, you know, h dot over h squared is small, and that's the general story. But that's what you mean by slow roll, is that?
Yeah. I just mean in the background trajectory, the parameters are small. No, yeah, exactly. That's just one thing. Now, for something a little bit more fun. So this is a plot which you may have picked up. It was tucked away in one of the WMAP9 papers. This is FNL per steradian. It's an attempt, I don't know, Ichiro is probably quite familiar with this, it's an attempt to point out where any FNL is coming from on the sky. Problem with this plot is, of course, you don't really know how to interpret these numbers. You don't really know whether this spot is significant or not, or whether that spot is non-Gaussian, etc. So this started. I started thinking about possibly using Bayesian statistics in a pixel-based non-Gaussianity estimator and implementing something like that. And in particular to get a Bayesian evidence for any non-Gaussianity in a map. And this is pixel-based localized non-Gaussianity estimates in a map. So very different from what we've been looking at all week in terms of large-scale asymmetries in power. I'm not going to go and look at large scales. I'm going to look at small scales in these maps. To do this, of course, you need a non-Gaussian likelihood, which I define in some way, but I apply it to a map by basically looking at, this is WMAP. I think, yes, it's a combination of three channels, QV and W. I define a non-Gaussian likelihood, and I run a nested chain over all pixels at a lower resolution than the native resolution of your map, and every pixel I can then fit for a second order parameter for the likelihood. It's just the variance plus any higher order, so in particular third order type non-Gaussianity. So you get a map from this procedure, you get a map of the variance relative to what you think the variance should be, because you've whitened and diagonalized the pixels in each of these low resolution pixels. And you can interpret these maps. What you can see here is that there's excess variance at various points in the sky. Of course, the galaxy has excess variance. And this is a third order skewness-like parameter for this analysis. And you can see that by eye, you can actually see the galaxy. Again, that map is a little bit hard to interpret. What can help is looking at the Bayesian evidence or ratio of evidences for non-Gaussian versus Gaussian model. So this is an attempt to do that. This is a map of evidence for non-Gaussianity in the sky. And I can report that with varying levels of confidence, the galaxy is non-Gaussian. Things like the, I think that's the LMC is non-Gaussian. So this is WMAP. So that's quite encouraging, of course, but not very informative. Although maybe the nicest thing about to take away from that is how Gaussian the galaxy is. None of those points actually lie outside. So anything above 3 or, well, 4.6 is very definitive. So anything that saturates that color scale, you could interpret as definitive evidence for non-Gaussianity. You do this on the Planck Smeeker map. So I've downloaded the Smeeker maps, and this is the kind of thing you see. No evidence outside of the Union 73 mask that there is any non-Gaussianity. I've been debating whether to show the next map all week. Francois, don't have a heart attack, please. so when I do, so again, if I look at the variance it wants and the skewness, something strange happens in the excess or relative variance map that I get for this. Of course, I do expect this Smeeker result to be more complicated than the WMAP case, because the half-ring noise description of something like Smeeker is probably not very good on the longest time scales in the rings, and therefore I expect to see this noise structure here with the ecliptic poles obvious, so it's picking that up. But then I see this weird isolatitude banding, which I don't see at all in the non-Gaussian parameter. Very strange. Yes. Yep, galactic coordinates, yeah. I've been scratching my head about this for a week. No, that would look more weird. Yeah, and it's very strange. So this, okay, this is what I was afraid of. So this map is a map of, I basically whiten these subpixels in a pixel all over the map. I diagonalize those pixels, I fit to a one-point distribution. One-point distribution wants a variance which is more or less than one. So that's the map. This is the map of that relative variance. Okay, so it wants more variance here around the poles. The noise is misestimated there. That's not unexpected because of the way I've based this on the half ring difference Smeeker noise realization. I just can't explain these isolatitude bands in any way. You can't see it in this skewness type parameter or in the evidence. I mean, you can play the game. You can try and see if you can see these bands in the original map. I've been staring at this long enough that... Yeah. I don't know. I've been doing this too long, so I have a biased view. But, yeah, there you go. So, anyway, I think this is a bit too preliminary to start worrying about this. I've tried, this takes a long time because I'm running a chain for each one of these pixels, so I've run a small fraction of a NILC and a 7, and I see some structure in it. I can't really tell if it's the same as Mika, but there is some. I can't run it on this. I have to cut out the signal. It's one of the things I've been trying to do. I've been trying to make a simulation which is fiducial enough with the same power spectrum and the same noise realization in it, but I was up until 2 yesterday morning and last night, and I couldn't get it run. Yes. No, so the noise map, I need to use that map as an estimate of the noise in a pixel. So I use a sample variance estimate of that noise realization to as the input noise when I whiten and diagonalize. I don't. Well, it effectively does this. I get another map for the variance of the of that estimate, and I don't see it. Right. The number of, no, is it? Yeah. No. So this structure I'm not worried about. No. So because the noise, the half ring noise, I may be misinterpreting it, but there's a realization of a half ring difference, which is actually the half ring difference passed through the Smeeker pipeline. That can't be a good estimate of the noise on the longest, on the scale of a ring. So I don't expect to see completely random uncorrelated noise in this map. No, not yet, no. I tried running this on one of the single frequency maps, but I ran into problems, yeah. Yeah, the banding. Yeah. I know, yeah. You can't see it. I've made a map of the number of pixels that go into it's there's no difference. No, I know, but if you look at the different contrasts, look at this. So there's a band there and a band there. So what is that band there? I know this one is close to the Heelpix boundary, but there's more structure than that in the and this is a very local estimate. So this pixel here doesn't know anything about anything else, right? So it's only, I disregard the covariance on any scale larger than the pixel.
Maybe we should move on, though, I think.
Yeah. I'll just leave it out.
I'm not doing my job. So who's
next? It's Andre.
Andre?
Going to tell us something equally interesting. Okay. Or more interesting, since I'm in the project.
Yeah. Right. So where's the mic? Just hold it up. Or it's nominally 5. I think maybe.
Well, actually, we should make sure they're in agreement.
So let's see, should I? Should I try to get the thing? Okay, should be good enough. Okay, so one of the things I want to talk about is that I've been doing pretty much the same sort of thing as Carlo Cantal did just now. I'm interested in mapping out local non-Gaussian features in the maps, not the smeared out over the entire sky, but that's the entire, like, you know, 1 hour talk, so ask me after. What if you care about. What I would rather end up talking about is the sources, physical sources, which can give you this sort of intermittent features on the sky. So this goes essentially back of quite a while ago with our CETA colleagues, Dick Bonte and Jonathan Braden, who are both here. And Essentially, the idea is, well, we started out on this project trying to figure out what happens dynamically at the end of inflation. Now it turned out to lead to the non-Gaussianity. And the type of non-Gaussianity you produce in this process is rather entertaining. Okay, so you know all the story very well. What do you do? Well, when you up on the potential, you inflate. Eventually, you roll down and you hit a bottom, at which point you have no choice but to dump all of your vacuum energy into other fields. Now, this usually happens in some sort of violent and nonlinear process. The big question is, can we actually ever see it, or do you just thermalize and have the temperature as the only thing that you ever get from this? Now, turns out it actually can leave an observable trace. And this is if you have other fields, not just the inflaton around. If you have second or third or many light fields, then they can modulate the expansion history and potentially change things. Okay, so what I need to do this, I will have to go from the potential, which is just one-dimensional, to the one which has more degrees of freedom. So here's the other one, like, you know, taking the same inflaton and give it some sort of other direction. So if it's light, I will have fluctuation in that other direction as well. So I will still roll down the inflaton direction from that side or the other side, and I will hit the bottom. And when I slosh around the bottom, I will, you know, my dynamics will strongly depend on what the shape of that bottom is, but essentially, you know, you just go and mix around there and you expand while you're doing this. Now, why this is interesting? Well, perhaps it is interesting because one of the things you don't know about inflaton is what is it and, you know, what kind of potential it is. And if you can say something about, like, you know, the shapes of these things near the bottom, that would be very interesting. So, the question of reheating is basically the question is what happens at the bottom of this thing, like, as opposed to what happens up on the top, where, you know, like, measurements from CMB tell you that it was pretty flat. All right, so how does this possibly can be observed? All of that reheating stuff happens on very small scales, like, you know, meter commoving, think about it, or something like that. Well, the idea is actually very simple. Expansion history of the universe, like different patches of it expand pretty much independently, but expansion history, of course, depends on initial conditions. This is your Gaussian random field, inflaton, and the other guys. Generally, like, you know, the standard thing you get is curvature of the inflaton gives you the change in the expansion history, so you drift out from constant curvature hypersurface, and you see this as curvature fluctuations of the sky when you go to constant density hypersurface. Normally, either curvature modes are not converted in the adiabatic mode if you're perturbative, so they are gone. But if you're nonlinear, they do get converted, and you might get the imprint of the revolution. Now, as long as you're rolling down an inflaton potential, you just have your Gaussian random field distributions everywhere, pointwise, and that cloud as a whole rolls down the potential. Everything is very smooth, nothing much happens, but once you start sloshing around near the bottom, you can start mixing. And when trajectories start mixing, you can see interesting things happening. For example, one of the classical things which happens when your light trajectories intersect, you get caustics like this guys on the water at the bottom of the lake. If this happens in your phase space, you can end up with the spikes in expansion history for certain values of the fields, for the size of the curvature modes. This will modulate curvature, and, you know, you can go and run three-dimensional simulations of the various boxes expanding in the universe to try to map out what that function is. It is, you know, a lot of numerical work and some subtleties involved, not only brute force, because you have to be very careful. Remember, your curvature fluctuations are 10 to the minus 5, so you're comparing to something of that order in the big boxes which expand violently. But anyway, after another 1 hour talk, hopefully I will not have to go over the things. Jonathan talked about it before the workshop starts, but if you want to know more, ask me or him once again. You end up with some function which tells you how expansion history depends on the value of either curvature field mode. And it turns out to be rather non-trivial. It has features. It has like lots of spikes which look like noise, but these are not really noise things. It's just positions where your caustics are in the field space. So if you hit one of these like magic things in the patch you're expanding, you will expand more. And if you don't, well, you expand like pretty much everybody else. This, of course, all of it happens on, like, you know, pretty small scale. So once you average over the your pixel size on the CMB sky, it becomes quite a bit smoother. So you essentially take this, you know, transfer function, which is nonlinear, and you smooth it by RMS of the noise, sorry, that you have inside the pixel you see. It becomes quite a bit much less entertaining, but still non-trivial function. So that's a green thing I have here. So let me blow it up. It looks kind of like that. And that, of course, depends on the parameters of the model or whatever you put in. Dynamics of the model might be different for different models, but you end up with some sort of non-trivial function. And that's what you pipe your Isaac curvature mode through. And you have here somewhere in the entire observable universe a constant value. Then you have, like, you know, spread around it in the pixels you see in CMB sky. So you sample that local region of the sky. The point is it actually has features about the same sky, like about the same field space span as you're sampling on the sky. So the very simple thing you can do to try to see how this looks like on a sky, take a fake map of, like, you know, scale invariant noise, apply it to it, and bury it into the usual CMB signal. By the way, first and second derivative of these guys are not constant, so the usual parametrization of just applying Taylor expansion is not very accurate. So usually what you do after you go after non-Gaussianity is you go after this coefficient, FNL, local non-Gaussianity estimator, right? This is, in usual analysis, it's always taken to be correlated with inflaton. And there you have very strong constraint. If you do this, it's now like 2, well, middle value plus minus 5. So you cannot play around with non-Gaussianity very freely anymore. But that depends on the assumption that these guys are correlated. What we have, if you have Isaac curvature mode conversion, then in fact, well, you don't get the simple Taylor expansion, which is okay or not okay, but much more importantly, this guy is coming from a different field. So that thing is not FNL of phi, it's FNL of something else. There is another map living in there, maybe more than one map. So you'll have to go and, you know, take another map for this guy and apply a nonlinear function to it and bury it in the original inflaton map, which is dominant source of curvature fluctuations. Now, if I apply that nonlinear function I've shown to you to this map around one of the peaks, like, you know, that's how it looks like. Smoothed out things. So because it's nonlinear and quite nonlinear, you end up with, you know, almost full rectification of the map, and you end up with, you know, features wherever your, like, hotspots is. Or more importantly, like, you know, where this magical value of the peak is. And this guy is buried in the data, so you have to watch out. If amplitude of this, like, you know, peaks is big enough to stick out of CMB, this is obvious. You don't even have to do F analysis, but if it's, like, you know, within 10% or 1% of the second map, then your FNL estimator is down, because you do this FNL, FNL, FNL function on the sky, and it's not everywhere on the sky, it's just in some places. So you get diluted if you do the full Fourier thing. So you get diluted by essentially how much, you know, fraction of the sky coverage is the intermittent map you do. Of course, this story, like, you know, what actual map you get depends very much where you land on this distribution. Let me remind you, the function looks like this, and I'm showing the span very, like, you know, of wide field values. So depending on how long inflation went, you might have been here, like, you know, on the entire observable last scattering surface plus fluctuations, or you could have been here plus fluctuations of about, like, you know, this size, or maybe here, or maybe there. So you can ask yourself how this thing changes as you sweep this, you know, chi super horizon value. And, well, to make things pretty, I made a movie. This is like happens as the time runs by, there is a linear sweep for the value, and I'm showing just a non-linear part of this function. So depending on whatever that thing is, it picks up features at given field value, and it basically goes from you know, places where you have hot spots and cold spots on the original Gaussian map. All of it is, of course, buried inside the usual Gaussian map you get from the fluctuations. So you should go and look for these things, like, you know, for the peaks. They might be obvious, they might be not, but you have. Physically, what is changing is how much, like, you know, the overall average field is for the entire observable sky, right? So normally, you totally don't care about the super horizon modes at all. They never contribute to anything observable. But in this guy, I'm sampling the distribution around some sort of field values, and dynamics does depend on the absolute, like, absolute values of the field. So you actually get to sample this super horizon mode. And because who knows how inflation was, like, lasting, this is basically a number drawn from distribution, which we don't even know the RMS of it, right? It could be anything. So you literally land anywhere on this sky, and then you have fluctuations around this. So this is extreme cosmic variance, if you want. Like, you know, that's why, you know, it's hard to tell what it's going to be exactly look like, because you don't know where you land, because you don't know how much inflation was going on. Yes? So the axis is, sorry, this was not labeled. This one is the difference in expansion history, so delta n, so essentially curvature fluctuation. This guy is the value of the isocurvature field. All right, so I should stop here, but you know, the interesting question is, of course, how do we search for this kind of nonviolent in the CMB? And I'll leave it here, ask me about Planck. So on the next slide, I have a, like, you know, Planck maps, but I'll stop here.
Are there any questions?
Yes, this trick is very well known, and I'm unashamedly using it. All right. So I'll make it brief. So essentially what you can do, you can go and run over and look at the peak excursions in the CMB map. There's like no subtleties to it. Essentially what you do, provide on the stuff, you can make sure the max are careful and smooth it with some kernel, and then look for peak statistics. So this is a SMICA map, which has been smoothed to about 13 degrees across, you know, with prevailing applied. Now, so you go, there is a, like, and look at it, there is a bunch of, like, you know, cold and cold spots. Again, the scale got erased in insertion. One of them is this cold spot, which has amplitude substantially bigger than the other things. So looking at this kind of map, you can, you don't even, you know where you can pull it off, but you can always ask yourself, is this Gaussian or not? So apart from linear, like, you know, transformations applied to the pipeline, I end up with this map, I can ask whether it's Gaussian or not. So what do? I extract every single peak on this map. I know its value in temperature. I can ask myself, does it look like distribution of peaks of Gaussian random field? And that's how it looks like. This is cumulative density function. So this, you know, crosses is actual peaks extracted from the map you've seen before. The green line is the fit to the distribution of the Gaussian random field. Cortesi to Dick and I guess Estacio and who else was up on that paper? Yes, just them. So this is a great fit. You know, these red bands are Kolmogorov-Smirnov test. So everything fits perfectly fine. It looks like a perfect example of Gaussian random field with, like, you know, 60th percentile spread of things in the test, except this one thing. That's a infamous cold spot. So you can estimate its significance. It comes out like, you know, one of a few hundred sort of number. That, of course, is, you know, debatable. And essentially, so what you can go and try to extract these maps is, no, by hitting these peak estimators, but one of the things you really want to do is, if you think that this is thing is non-Gaussian feature, you want to map it out and see how it looks like, because different things look differently. And instead of one number, try to do a local map of these things, but that's entire new talk. So I'll stop here, and thanks for the question.
Any other questions you want to
ask? Yeah.
Oh,
okay.
Okay, can you go back at your formula for what the curvature fluctuation was in terms of these two fields?
Yep.
That, yeah. So I guess the trick that you've done is to hide some very non-Gaussian field under some very Gaussian mm-hmm. field. And you motivated this with the end of inflation, blah, blah, blah. I wonder why in that context should this, if the second function is very non-Gaussian, why this should not be a function of both things and both very, very non-Gaussian in both, and as a result the FNL would kill you? I mean, why, how did it, I mean, the direction it was coming and the direction in this end thingy, Biller stuff complicated, how did it know that in one direction it has to be a perfectly linear and in the other one, it's a complication?
Okay, so there is a, it's a good, very good question, and there is a sensible answer to it. Your inflaton is essentially time translation. So the only thing that matters for all of this sort of thing, at which angle you go into the bottom of the potential, which is the ratio of inflaton and the other guy. So that's why you get one of the direction, just time translation thing, and the other one affects the dynamics. Yep. So, but as you go into initial conditions, essentially, like, you know, that time translation along the inflaton is just the time translation for you. But the only thing that makes the trajectories go different, not by time shift, is essentially the angle at which you go into the bottom.
Yeah, but you're not converged. I mean, the phi is essentially hitting the epsilon one, which is
quantum fluctuations as you go into it. And then the remarkable thing is that the trajectories that start off being really, really close to each other do the diverse. It's the classic thing. Right. Yeah, but you wouldn't get that with the phi, changing the phi initial condition variable just in the longitudinal direction.
Yes. In the spirit of full disclosure, I have to add that this guy might have linear path. Then you have linear combination of phi and psi. And then you cross-correlate, and then FNL might kill you. So that's exactly a critical question, whether how much of this cross-correlation you do, right? And that is basically, you know, what you have to watch out for. So these guys, you know, depend on how much of this amplitude of the curvature fluctuation you produce. Let me bring this function in. So that linear correlation part depends very strongly on how high this graph is. So. Yes. So,
Stop. You can get an equivalent regime of an FNL type expansion, but it's the effect of FNL is relaxed a lot because it's got the power in the original inflaton field plus the power in the sky field, which are down weighting quite a bit.
So the crucial question is, like, you know, just how high this graph is. If you have a lot of the linear admixture in it, like, you know, if these guys really go high in amplitude, then you're, of course, you know, constrained by all the things. If this guy is, you know, low, then you very much partially, like you know, subdominant to the main inflaton, so you're not very well correlated, even if you have linear component. The scary thing is, like, in our first models, we tried lambda phi to the fourth, the number of this thing, which is, by the way, does not relate to the inflaton amplitude, comes up to 1 × 10⁻⁵, which is, like, you know, within few factors of one from the actual number that I start worrying about, like, in the normalization of my transfer function now, which is not what the theorists usually do. But anyway, so no numbers have been, like, you know, tweaked in this, but your mileage might vary because different models, of course, will do different things.
Okay, maybe. Thanks a lot. Maybe who's? Oh, I'm sorry.
You have a.
I have a temperature field, and then I'm trying to decompose this in two fields. All right, and one is supposed Gaussian, and the other one is essentially arbitrary, and mm-hmm. So. It's a little bit weak to go after it, right? I mean, it can be anything.
Yes.
Right? And so I have one number, and I need to extract two numbers, and with only Gaussian statistics on the first one.
Yes, that is
you
correct.
You have a pretty wonderful playground here.
Yes. I'm a theorist. I like playgrounds. But on more serious note is that since there is a lot of flexibility in probably how this function looks like, if I go after estimators, I probably shouldn't model them in any sort of reasonable sense. I should just literally go.
Well, that's what I was driving at. I mean, you know, because, I mean, if you are trying to look for the deviation of non-Gaussianity and entropy, if you have essentially no handle whatsoever, I mean, be zoology or I mean.
I mean, well, there are a lot of things in astronomy which you can, like, you know, call by that label. There are lots of, like, objects. I mean, the question is really, like, other sort of, you know, object sort of things buried in there. Mm-hmm. And you can go after that and try to map them out. So it was very not easy to do, like, you know, when we didn't have many pixels. So mm-hmm. Now we have a lot more pixels, so if I'm willing to lose my square root of n, I can go to much smaller patches of the sky and...
But then to try to get a little bit more handle, I mean, would you have any kind of generic predictions of what you would expecting what you would expect to find in the image, for instance?
This is a very good question.
Otherwise, all right, I do sort of some kind of decomposition, right, on the T, and then what do I do next?
Okay, so very good. Guys, I literally primordial potential, gradient potential, the whole sitting on the last scattering surface, the stuff will flow into it. You should, if this is a real feature, should have like corresponding a quite real feature and polarization map, which is, you know, not from the same time, but highly correlated. It's like more than 60%, if I remember correctly, correlation between actual potential temperature in the modes. So the very, like, you know, thing I'm very much, you know, waiting for is these polarization maps when they drop out of the, like, you know, great machine. Then the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to try to cross-correlate them and see if there is excess, you know, in cross-correlation around these places. Again, I want to do it properly.
Okay, maybe we should move on to, are you? So Dick will take over. There's a mic.
So I'm just going to do a few comments which are somewhat related to comments I made at an equivalent panel at the SLAB meeting in that we had a couple of weeks ago. But I'm going to focus on something. But I'm going to focus on something that is okay. That is of great interest to us, which is robustness of NS. Of course, we've heard the big issue is NS being away from unity is. You know, that's one of the big accomplishments of Planck, that we've gone into the five sigma realm, and so particle physicists would say it's a real thing. But I like to relate all of this stuff to the acceleration histories of the universe. And so you can do acceleration history reconduction. This is my executive summary here, because I have no doubt I won't be able to get through the few slides I have. And one can relate the early universe acceleration histories to the late universe acceleration histories, which is the story of the equation of state parameter as a function of A, and you can use essentially the same techniques. And the paradox, which I have been singing the curiousness of for a very long time, is that we know more about the early inflaton dynamics than we do about the late inflaton dynamics. And that's for a reason that I'll mention in a moment, but that is quite a paradox that we think we know so much about the ultra-early universe and we don't know so much about the universe around us. The other aspect is that in both cases, we have around us a differentially accelerating vacuum, not just an accelerating vacuum, but one that has an acceleration that changes. And that's one of the things that also comes out of Planck. Okay, so reconstruction was only skipped over in Hiranya's talk, and she talked about searching for features in the primordial power spectrum. But we did have in the Planck inflation paper an attempt at a reconstruction, but it was trying to do quite a high resolution reconstruction. And one of the artful things that you have to do is to try and regularize it, because you otherwise what can often happen is you get very wiggly things, and it sort of, at least visually, gives you somewhat misleading results. So one way to do that, and we've done this for other data in the past, is to use just a simple spline fit with mode functions at points that are called knots. And in this case, there are 9 knots. So what one is doing is increasing the number of parameters. Instead of an NS parameter, there are a whole sequence of knot values of the log of the power spectrum with a normalization. You let the overall normalization flow as one does in the overall amplitude of the fluctuation, and then you allow an R value, and it turns out
that consistency allows you to do reconstructions of all sorts of things, like the potential as a function of field, and in particular the acceleration, which I'll talk about in a bit, as a function of the expansion factor, basically. But the remarkable things that comes out of this, so if you, is that this is the best fit for Planck plus WP plus high L. This line here, that's what it says. You just give it the NS value and amplitude, and here it is on this figure. And you do these nine knots with the interaction between the knots, to be sure. And then these are the one sigma allowed trajectories, or some sample of them, which shows you, number one, that over a very large range in K, it really says I'm not going to do any deviation whatsoever from NS. So this is a very high resolution way of looking at the NS problem and the fact that it doesn't want to do breaks. Then something happens at the end, which is that the data starts to not be highly constraining, some of it being sample variance. There is an overall rough tendency at lower L for it want to make use of the dropping of the power. This is a thing that was discussed a lot in the course of the meeting, that there, you know, is a little bit of trending, but within the one sigma, it isn't going to really dominate things. And there was also a little dip in the 217 data, which may have had a little bit of a pulling influence here, but you can see that the spread of allowed trajectories is extremely high. And the bottom line to take away from this is how amazing that with all of these parameters stuck in, that you get NS being constant, that it really does like that solution, even though it can do all sorts of other things. And I'm going to contrast that to what was in the inflation paper, where this is the best fit, which is wandering all over the place because it was being done with really quite high resolution, and it had an overall stiffness parameter, which is de facto being put in by only allowing for the nine knots. And I wouldn't say that we really have more leverage on the data than adding much more than that. This can, you know, do a blind search, and eventually that will happen with the Planck data as we go forward, especially when we add polarization, which can do a great thing, which maybe I'll show you right here. Here is a forecast for the future of what this sort of thing might look like with SPIDER and Planck and a long time downstream Euclid and Chime, of course. This is our favorite toy these days. And you know, you can get really, really flat lines. So I'll come back to this. And you can get very good gravity wave constraints. So we should be able to determine things extremely well, especially when we get the polarization results, because things that you can try and do with just the TT, you can't get away with once you have the polarization results. So what you can do is you can translate what we just saw into acceleration trajectories. Epsilon is 1 plus the so-called deceleration parameter as a function of time. And the amazing thing is that the power spectrum as a function of ln k can be related to the dynamics, ln ha, because there's a rough relationship between resolution and ln ha. And so translating what you just saw into acceleration trajectories, this sort of gives the one sigma band of allowed trajectories, which are sort of clustered down to low values. Some of this depends upon exactly how you try and do parameterizations, but it's a pretty neat concept saying, I can look at the dynamics of the acceleration trajectories in the ultra early universe over about 8 E foldings with a reconstruction. I think that's a pretty beautiful thing to draw. And just to add some other points, because of the nature of this expansion and the use of consistency in the allowed inflationary trajectories, things are not as simple as going after the R value, which is essentially a value of epsilon at one pivot point, and then you have a forced NS. And so here, is at the pivot point where you're usually quoting the R limit. This would be the derived epsilon limit at the 95% confidence limit. So you see that we're actually looking at somewhat different things. And so allowed trajectories actually with this set of degrees of freedom, they look like they're in contradiction to the R limit. And that's because the R limit is a very restricted thing because we're adding all of these other constraints. We're essentially saying you've got to have constant NS when you do an R limit, for example. Okay, do I want to say it? Here's a likelihood function. Here's the value of tensor to scalar ratio. And so for a second, I'll pretend I'm Jamie Bock, who didn't make it up. This is where we are now with a sort of a likelihood curve. This was with WMAP9, ACT, and SPT. It hasn't been updated for the Planck values. And so the limits are, well, there's a point at the, you know, there's a 95% confidence limit of about 0.12 with this stuff if you add large scale structure. And where are we headed? And that's what the whole purpose of this is. This is the, somewhere here, the so-called live bound. One certainly wants to break through that. And here are a sequence of potentials, and you want to break through that. And the reason I'm putting this up is that we did a whole bunch of forecasting for experiments, balloon, based upon the ground, et cetera. Spiders, something that that we heard a little bit about at this meeting, and there are two, you know, some versions of that that would get you down through the live bound, more or less. And so that's the territory, and that's going to be launched, at least in this realm, this one here, in hopefully November. ABS is an experiment out of Princeton that we also have involvement in, and it has an equivalent kind of curve. I think it's sort of two on top of each other, remarkably enough. And then we also did some forecasting for something using different technology, Quiet2, which isn't funded, but it could also get in that territory. And this isn't the only thing that's going on. Keck might be able to get into this territory too. And so the next big thing is to go from here to here. Then, and you know, Planck will be able to get down into this territory. It won't, we don't think, be able to get right down here. It all depends upon issues of subtraction. Then another great leap forward is if we actually do go to space again with a dedicated thing. And there are two concepts that have been floating out there, three, because there's a Japanese one, Lightbird, but I don't know where it would get to. But there's CORE, which is a European proposal, which we just heard about, with lots and lots and lots of detectors, and PIXIE with the Fourier transform spectrometry. And this is the way the situation would look with such a thing if we had a fiducial model with a R of 0.001. You would get a detection like that if you could control your foregrounds well enough. Okay, dark energy trajectories, acceleration trajectories with no time left. That shows you the acceleration history of the universe as reconstructed in an artful way. And this shows the equation of state or trajectories. And the point I just want to make here is, first of all, once you get chimes, Euclids, et cetera, that can really add to BAO constraints, you would get a bundle of acceleration trajectories, which would be really quite limited if it really was a vacuum energy. But this is where we are right now with Planck and the supernova legacy survey values. Look at this one up here. If you allow W to go negative, then the data is trying to pull it negative, and that's because of this issue we have with the supernova legacy survey, which may get modified, and it's not clear that that's going to happen, but that's what came out of the S-Lab thing. So that pulls you down. It means to me you'd better not write a paper on adding supernova at this stage, because you're probably going to have egg on your face, or unless they actually stick with those values. If you say, I'm going to make a physical restriction that you can't have phantom dark energy, and that's not an unreasonable prior to put on, then these are the allowed trajectories. But the interesting point is that in both cases of dark energy, whether it's the early inflaton dark energy or the late inflaton dark energy, pseudo-inflaton it may be, collective field it may be, in either case, the essential thing that we're talking about is acceleration and reconstruction of the acceleration histories of the universe. It's just that in the early universe, we get to do about 10 e-foldings of it, and in the late universe, we get to do only a little bit over one e-folding, which is a bit of a tragedy for the late universe, but we're certainly putting a lot of bucks into the attempt to try and do that one e-folding of reconstruction of the late universe dark energy trajectories.
I think I actually have a suggestion that we should just go through the speakers and then open it up, because we're actually getting a little bit late in time. So I think, Matthias, do you want to go next? Do you have just when did you use the...
So I just want to keep it short. The first thing I want to do is, as I was part of the organizing group, I really want to thank KITP. I think at least I had a lot of fun this week. I think the conference, as far as I can tell, worked pretty well. And I really want to thank for them imposing us this particular format, which at some point or another I forcefully objected to, but it was they were right. I think it worked a lot very well, and I really liked all of the questions, and it was for me it was a lot of fun. And I also want to thank the Planck people a lot. Not just for the talks and, of course, of the data, that was great, but also because they, took some risks, they showed new stuff. I'm sure some of these new stuff required approvals, and I'm sure the people here were instrumental in that, and this might even lead to some uncomfortable situations down the line. And so, I think for the rest of us, it's great, and the openness to discuss all of these things, at some level to show the dirty laundry, which everybody has, by the way, First DOW map, tau was 0.17, right? So that dirty laundry always everybody has, and so it's great to discuss all these things, and I'm really grateful that you guys did that. In terms of the conclusions that I get from this meeting, for myself at least, and I will spend very little time because everybody, probably already has said the same things. And so the discovery of NS different from one, I think, is spectacular. Francois showed this plot with the various measurements of the power spectrum as a function of time and how where Planck sits in all of this. That's spectacular. But the other thing that we just witnessed before our eyes is the moment in which measuring endpoint function of the CMB has become routine, pretty much. It used to be the power spectrum. Now you guys can measure three-point functions, the Lenzing reconstruction. These talks were just beautiful, okay? The measurement of the peculiar velocity, all of this, so three-point function, Lenzing, four-point function, piece of cake. That's the conclusion that I take from this. And furthermore, the additional talks of the future, magic telescopes, half the sky with arc minute resolution, 150 sigma Lenzing detection. So this means sigma 8 we will know perfectly in a very near future. Tau will go away as one of these priors that we usually have. We'll go back into the foreground part of the likelihood very soon. And the neutrino masses. So I think it's just fantastic. In terms of the data, the things for the near future are just incredible. Also, we are about to see the transition in which EE polarization is, started to tell us that. As we just heard about shapes of the power spectrum, all kind of things. This will be great. And Jamie Bogg was not here, so we didn't hear so much about future B-mode experiments, but that's the next transition that we will start seeing in CMB, which is also incredible. and large-scale structure and time and SPT. So in terms of data, this is just incredible. I think it's a very lucky time, and we're all jealous, the ones that we're not doing. I mean, I'm not really jealous of not being doing these experiments because I hate telecoms, and so I cannot, I could not do any of these, and I also am stuck at coding and everything. So, so by any case, it's incredible. Now, in terms of the theory and all of this discussion, I think it's quite, I mean, we'll hear the correct perspective from Eva at the end, so I don't want to say very much. It's interesting to see how everybody positions themselves. We've known the universe started in a, or the hot Big Bang started in a particularly strange initial conditions, if you like. We know for a while that that we can invent something that came before the hot Big Bang that can kind of produce this as a final condition, the initial conditions that now we've characterized incredibly well. So these we've known from quite a while. We've also known for quite a while as well that we've been looking for alternatives and to inflation, and this has not been particularly successful endeavor so far. So. But maybe it will change. I don't know. But we also have learned that even in the context of inflation, there's all these different mechanisms and different things that could have happened. Inflation is a very broad thing. We also know that some of these mechanisms can be distinguished by these observations. Some of them cannot be distinguished. Let alone be sure that we are actually witnessing inflation, even though we can fit for all of the parameters of the model. But we making sure that it's the right model. It's maybe slightly different, and we are confronted with this situation in which it's great. Given any particular example, we can do the calculations, but there are many examples, and pretty much all of the results from observations we could actually, in principle, fit. So when we say that we make our model makes predictions. Sometimes we should say our model can fit the data. Okay, I can adjust parameters such that I can fit the data. Right. So we tend to use. It's nice how we tend to use these very interesting. I mean, we tend to try to sell. I mean, it's everybody does it, including myself. But it's very clear. And well, unfortunately, we're turning a lot of rocks, and some not so many things are showing up, and so. And so many things will continue to feed, and how we handle this as the field is not so obvious. What will happen? We saw some examples in some of the talks. We have our friends that were around from the 80s, which want to shut off any possible different scenario model, different complication. Everything was done. M square phi square, although I am the big proponent of M square phi square, but for a different reason, not because I had anything to do with it, but because at least you can predict from one number three things. So, while in other cases you can't. But that's one attitude. The other attitudes are. Some more phenomenological attitudes, like the ones that I typically have, or my friends, and which are also sometimes funny. They boil down to saying Weinberg was a great physicist. He wrote down the pi on Lagrangian, and that's all there is to it. And we will use it everywhere. We usually tend to say, look, with this pi on Lagrangian, we can get this non-Gaussianity. Go look for it. And then when it's not there, we already knew that there's a big parameter space. So this is kind of, and to make the argument even more convincing, we tend to say Weinberg. This is the same Weinberg that brought us the anthropic principle, which I'm sure in this crowd buys a lot of, support. Anyway, I just want to thank all of you for the talks. It has been great, and especially the Planck people, both for their data and the talks that, based on the things in the paper, and also the things that they showed us that were not in the papers. Thank you.
Should I go for questions?
Yeah.
Okay, it's really hard to add anything to what Matthias said. First of all, I want to repeat his thanks to the KITP, including the many staff members who help in so many ways that make it easy for us to put together the scientific program. And I think we should all thank Matthias particularly for the program since he took the lead on this conference. So I've enjoyed every single talk. I haven't understood everything in every single talk, and I find the field, incredibly vibrant. The data being the highlight these days, of course. Congratulations again to all the Planck people. And it's kind of interesting that we do intersect in a few numbers that we all talk about from so many different sides. The issues that we all deal with to get there are very different. You can look at the fact that there's any intersection at all as a great thing. That's my optimistic point of view. Or you can just say, oh, it's a few numbers, what can you learn? And you're not even allowed to consider all the numbers. But my view is the more optimistic one, that we should milk this for whatever it is worth, and as we've been discussing. This overlap is pretty interesting. So we had these two theory talks about the top-down and bottom-up, for example, and I wanted to emphasize how symbiotic they've really been. It hasn't been, a lot of the work building up effective field theory came through mechanisms derived from here and vice versa, and I hope that interface will continue regardless of what the phenomenology ends up being. I think we've learned a lot, for example, about time-dependent quantum field theory and all sorts of interesting phenomena just at the theoretical level from these things. Of course, we're all most interested in what's really observed and excited about what's been improved there. And the kind of distinctions that Matthias alluded to are real. That's part of why some of us keep asking this annoying question. You say all these interesting things about the details, and then we just say, well, okay, how far down are you going to get in the tilt? And the reason is that it's very significant for making the kinds of distinctions that Matthias just alluded to. Just as one example, the way axions work is a beautiful example of this, where from the top down, there's a certain structure that emerges where there's an underlying periodicity, but on each branch of the potential, it goes over a large field range and flattens out. That's how axions work from the top down in string theory. From the bottom up, the original picture of axions was rather different, requires a periodicity that's too large for what you get from the top down. These don't overlap in this silly little Venn diagram. And the data, if the tilt and R can be detected at the level you have been telling us, will distinguish these two possibilities, just as an example. So that's still very exciting, and that's just, again, one example of many such distinctions that we hope to be able to make. These attitudes are somewhat different, so you often hear expressed the idea that you can write down whatever you want and fill in these numbers, continuously. I'm skeptical of that, although I don't know if it's going to make an observational difference. I think there will be, at best, a discrete set of possibilities in complete theories. A few years ago, people made strong claims that there was a bound on the field range, which is clearly not true. It was not a very logical argument in the first place. Still, there are some structural constraints, and I don't think this is continuous. Although, we have to emphasize that even from this top-down point of view, it seems that large or small field is perfectly fine, as we've been saying. So, another place where there might be a non-overlap is in exotic possibilities like ghosts or W less than minus one, which we heard about in some talks even, which most people would guess do not have a UV completion. And so, those sorts of things are also interesting. So let me discuss a little bit more this business of how depressing it is if it's just a few numbers. So I just want to make a somewhat silly but I think important point that single numbers can be extraordinarily significant from a theoretical point of view, the biggest one being the cosmological constant. If you just think of it as a number that can be positive, can be negative, zero, or positive, Those distinctions are enormous from the theoretical point of view. They change the causal structure of space-time. In the case where lambda is negative, there's a very simple theoretical understanding of that that's developed, you know, fairly recently, but it's complete now. And in contrast, the lambda greater than zero situation that we're actually in the universe is one in which there are horizons, disconnection, causal disconnection between different regions, and not a complete theory. So this, you know, single number makes an enormous difference. And the tensor-to-scalar ratio is not on that level of significance, in my opinion, but it's second to the cosmological constant because of this Lyth relation between the field range and the threshold of 0.01-ish for the tensor-to-scalar ratio. Again, because this is, you know, everybody agrees is UV-sensitive to quantum gravity issues. And so making the distinction between these two is a significant threshold, and it's, in other ways, it's analogous to the LHC getting through the electroweak scale in terms of testing ideas for symmetry principles and so on. So, you know, there are some numbers that are not that significant, but some single numbers really are, and this is one of them. So, okay, I don't really need to go on. This was sort of what I was thinking before the data came out, that we might have precision tests from non-Gaussianity, and, you know, that we would hope for some additional constraints in this plane, which we have found. There's some theoretical top-down prejudice for flattening the potential at large values compared to m squared phi squared as massive fields in a favorable way, which is how it works, for example, for axions. I know I've become a broken record on this point, but that's the last thing I'll say about it. And, you know, that hope was realized at the level we've been talking about. This beautiful plot shows, you know, enhanced constraints from Planck and the other experiments that we've heard about. So what do we do next? Of course, you guys probably have better ideas. This is just some random thoughts. We could, in the from this top-down theoretical point of view, we could start being more serious about small changes in R and NS that might come, or reducing our uncertainties in it by understanding better reheating, issues involving multiple fields, et cetera. There's an interesting possibility that's been discussed of oscillatory signatures that are kind of hard to analyze for, as far as I understand it. But which would be very interesting, so maybe there's some work to do to pin that down better from both points of view. And from the super top-down point of view, we have a long road ahead of us to build up our understanding of the structure and the statistics of time-dependent string theory backgrounds, both for reasons of phenomenology and for reasons of understanding the framework for cosmology. That's very much an open question. So. I don't have any new results to give this on this, but this is perhaps a good time to open it up to everyone's vision of what to do next in cosmology. So maybe we should go to that.
Yeah, so we should open it up. There are two things we have to do before. The first thing is, I think this is the right time to thank the organizers of this conference, where Dick, Chris Arata, Eva and Matthias. This has been a lot of fun for all of us. The second thing is not as pleasant. I'm told that there is a hard deadline. People that need to go to the hotel and take the shuttle, the shuttles are out there now, and they're not going to wait indefinitely. So those of you that need the shuttles are going to have to think about that. So with those two pleasant and unpleasant things, now I think we really can open it up. And so I hope people will now react to things that we've heard. So do people have questions, comments, objections? There's not a single reaction. I guess people are tired. But yeah.
In your first slide, you had everything was overlapping with everything except the string theory in quantum field theory. The thing was empty.
No, they're overlapping. Sorry, they're meant to overlap, but they're not fully overlapping. Sorry, what's... Oh, the hash things were only to do with observations because that's more the theme of the meeting. I'm sorry. But there are things that are studied from the bottom up that probably aren't UV complete. So that it's not maybe that big a...
So my understanding is that, you know, with the observational success of inflation, at least as you know, people have done the calculations of what you expect from it. Basically, you do the simplest kind of calculations you can do in inflation, but yet there's assumptions you have to put in. Those assumptions seem to be validated by what we're observing. For example, that inflation started, and that if you assume you're just in the ground state as it gets going, are those? But then the questions are, you know, why do those assumptions work? And I'm curious, how does, you know, whether we're in the large field or small field, interact with those questions?
Okay, well, there's one part of that that's easy to answer, and the biggest question you're asking is, of course, as you know, not easy to answer, but for large field, you're also at a higher Hubble scale, so the patch that you need to begin inflating is that much smaller. And in that sense, it's more, just in that sense alone, it's more natural. You don't have to assume as large an initial patch to get the process going. It's also, for what it's worth, which may not be, you know, what nature chooses, it's the case we understand, which is natural in the Tuft, in the sense of Tuft and Wilson, where there's a symmetry that protects the model, the theory of the potential over the range that the inflaton varies. So both of those things in themselves reduce the tuning relative to the other options, but that is not conclusive at all. We don't have a good theory of initial conditions. If you try and evolve back further, you hit singularities or other bubbles or, you know, all sorts of wild stuff that we don't have a full framework for. So, you know, within a limited context, you can come to, you know, conclusions about what, how to compare different levels of tuning of initial conditions or potentials, et cetera. But the ultimate questions, we don't understand. That's part of why this field is so interesting, is because it's not just a matter of fitting parameters to a framework that we completely understand. There are big questions behind it that we don't understand and that we can work on. So that's probably not a very satisfying answer, but it's...
my only comment is that physics is very good at, given some physical system and some initial conditions, computing the final conditions, but inferring A, what the system is, and the initial conditions are not, it's not a physics problem in reality. It's, we are turning it into a physics problem by making some assumptions, and from the assumptions something follows. But weighting the assumptions is not so much of a physics problem, and unless we create another physics problem in which these assumptions are the conclusions of this previous physics problem, right? Inflation, in some sense, is the previous physics problem for which the initial conditions of the hot Big Bang are the outcome. But I don't know, it's getting dicey, and with few numbers, the only problem is debating about priors is really uninteresting, right? Especially when they are psychological priors of the authors.
Well, it's not a textbook physics problem.
Those are the most interesting for, you know, discussing and seeing in AstroPH, but...
I mean, when you say large versus small field, you might be thinking about the overshoot problem for a small field,
You had brought up, you know, is that this is an important distinction, a threshold to determine whether you know, R is greater than 0.01 or less than 0.01. So I was
right. Well, that's there are different reasons for that, but the one I was emphasizing here was just the fact that I think is not controversial, that the greater than possibility is the one which is infinitely UV sensitive, in the sense that it's sensitive to an infinite sequence of Planck suppressed operators. So it's the case where we really do, you know, need this top-down approach.
So does that one throw into even greater, you know,
emphasis, the trying to understand why aren't we seeing any stuff from higher scales filtering in? I mean, some smaller length scales, I mean, higher energy scales.
Well, those things do affect, even if you assume inflation is the right answer, et cetera, those higher scale degrees of freedom affect the question of what the effective action for the inflaton is. That is, if you start with a theory with a potential that inflates and then you add to it some Planck suppressed contribution, the sort of thing that you would get by accounting for your ignorance of high scale physics, it affects these slow roll parameters, gives a contribution to them that's 100 times of what you guys measure.
Right.
So this is why it's an opportunity. On the other hand, it's completely fair to say the inverse problem is, extremely hard starting from two numbers. But this one number, in the sense I've just mentioned, is, it's telling you that if you try to do a Taylor expansion in this potential with Planck suppressed, powers of phi divided by m Planck, you would have to control an infinite sequence of those. So that's the statement.
Right. And then from what Dick showed, what we actually see looks extraordinarily simple.
Right. But what Dick showed, as you know, is consistent with either of these possibilities until we do the B mode measurement. I'm sorry, I'm not...
I guess I'm just getting at... It seems like you're saying... Maybe I'm misunderstanding something. But it seems like you're saying, we have greater sensitivity to, Planck scale stuff in the large field regime. And so it seems like in that case, it's even more of a mystery why what we see is just... We're not seeing any evidence of sub-Planckian physics, right? Sorry, I mean super Planckian. Yes, thank you.
Well, I'm not exactly getting your point. Inflation tends to dilute, of course, relics from the early universe regardless. But what we're saying is that the modeling inflation itself requires controlling effects from quantum gravity that would affect the process at order one.
I mean, not what you said, okay. Which I agree with, because I agree with everything you say, but having the field move, the real problem with inflation is that we see the effective potential surface over such a small amount. And the advantage of the large field models is we see it over a little bit more, but not very much. And it's not like we're probing, really large ranges. So the other point, which is sort of obvious, is that we were not uncomfortable for arbitrarily many years to have delta phi greater than m Planck. And then it became the law that one shall not, because somehow something amazing was going to happen once you hit M Planck. It was associated with, there were a few ideas floating around, but, and good friends of mine who are very distinguished and may have even given a talk earlier in the conference were telling me very clearly that this was, the end of doing the R experiments. And then Eva came along and said, all you have to do is you have to go around this thing and you just make it an angle, and the angle just can keep going around, and you just do a little bit of acceleration of it, and you get out of this bound. And in the first instance, it sounded like, oh, that's really contrived. And then you start to see that, in fact, it's pretty generic. I would regard it as pretty generic possibility, because it follows along the pseudo-Nambu-Goldstone. I have a fondness for them. And as Eva said, she has a fondness for them. But I mean, that's the way to be able to do this stuff fairly easily. So that means that you don't hit anything that's really a Planckian problem.
So you don't
have energy densities which are that high.
Yeah, so sorry, Dick's last sentence was what I was going to try and use to help clarify. It's not a Planckian energy density ever. In fact, these flatter models are lower in energy density than, say, m squared phi squared, the old simplest model. But it's sensitive to contributions to the potential that are powers of phi divided by M Planck, which are the things that you need a UV completion to calculate. That's a just a standard statement in field theory. It doesn't mean this is going to be the right answer. It just means it's a very interesting threshold, and I'm just trying to. Yes.
The, for Higgs, the Higgs vacuum is about 246 GeV, and we noticed, we observed Higgs mass to be around 125.6. So fraction of M Planck, can it cause also, I mean, the same question? I mean, if a fraction of M Planck is just traversed by the field, for example, a tenth, is it also the same kind of problem that you raise? We have we have some new physics at M Planck over 10, as in electroweak symmetry breaking, we notice at V over 2 approximately.
He's running away. I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand.
I said if M Planck just plays a sacred role, I mean, or if can it be M Planck over 10, for example, and then R less than 1% would be just as problematic. I mean, a bit, of course, less than 1% will be a bit problematic. I learned it from Shamit, actually. So this he raised this issue that, I mean, a fraction of M Planck can also be problematic. So. And the other thing is that I think in large field models, the uncertainty in initial condition you can obtain R less than 1% for large field models, as I told you initially. So I mean, you can reach R of about 10 to the power of minus 3 if you consider uncertainty in the initial condition for tensor and scalar perturbations, even for M squared, phi squared.
Did you want to answer or comment?
Well, we had this discussion before, and I disagreed about taking such a strongly non-bunched Davies initial state. I think it would back act enormously and not keep you in the attractor.
I based my initial condition I and also Holman and Foley have the papers in the bound condition. The factory actual amount of
Bogoliubov coefficient was just, I'm just quoting from them, so I can't comment on that. I just took that just trusted them.
If you start the system excited away from the Bunch-Davies vacuum, you can do that under control by keeping your physical momentum well below the Planck scale, and then it dilutes. So it could be some relic very early, but then it dilutes.
So the way they model it is that they are saying that it's at very large values, so at large momenta, it's just beta is basically zero, but there is a physical momentum M, in which when there is a momentum M, which is the scale of new physics, and when the physical momentum of the mode reaches that point, the mode gets excited. So if they have used this kind of modeling. So it's just, I mean, there's a new physics at a scale M, and beforehand the mode is just in its vacuum.
Okay, it's possible that you could have particle production during inflation, work on a steeper part of the potential. That does work, I agree with that, if that's what you're saying. Maybe we should discuss it offline.
That's what they say, and it's still beta is.
Yeah, that's fine, but that goes beyond the basic M squared phi squared model, which is fine, but it's a very different case.
Yeah, so to move away from the kind of technical discussion, just to loop back to the optimism versus pessimism that sort of happily dogged much of this conference. If your few numbers remain zero, or the unmeasured few numbers remain zero, at what point do we just stop? Do we just give up hope and say we're not learning anything anymore?
Okay. Other people should come into this. then, you know.
Just to, maybe we should throw in Ichiro's, you know, running of the coupling constant as well as
just
another.
Say, just say it's all not there. First of all, we learn a lot from, you know, from the one number. A null result on R is also very informative, so it's not a bad thing to have done if it turns out zero or constrained. It's a great thing to have done in the same way that it was great to do that with local FNL to the extent that it's been done so far. You get precision tests from that. You learn something there. And then, you know, all I can say personally is theoretically there are still these huge questions. Any situation in which there's less than one theory, even if there's no data, there's a lot of work to still do. And for these ultimate questions, that's the situation that we're still in. So we have more to do. But as far as this little overlap goes, you're right, it would become less useful. Maybe.
There's no such thing as zero, but yeah, there's a practical limitation. The issue, which I think you're really alluding to, or maybe not, is in that forecasted likelihood curve, a really nice level of the order of 0.003, let's say, you know, subject to some of the issues associated with foreground removals for R. And will we make a choice for a satellite, which I think we'd all be happy about, but will we make a choice for a satellite, will governments make a choice for a satellite, until we know what those results are? If we see something, then you want to go and really nail it. And if we don't see something, you could say, well, I'm just going to push down the energy level of inflation just a tiny little bit. Do we really care at that point? Because we will have broken through the tilde 0.01 barrier, in which you are really going from the whole class of many models that were famous into and ancient into something where something really quite dramatically different occurs. But since unfortunately we aren't going to get to R of 10 to the minus 10, you aren't going to be able to go to the real territory. So that will be a really interesting issue. And I guess my view is I imagine there will be a microwave background follow-on satellite, but it could be in the year 2300 rather than in the years that matter to us, because, you know, it'll happen eventually, but it's a question of whether it becomes a priority. And you can see that, and I think quite rightly, Europe put its bet on Euclid, not on CORE, but they're keeping CORE going, as far as I understand, in terms of some modest funding so that it doesn't disappear. And I think the same thing is happening with Pixie. So there's a hedging of the bets. And I guess that's my view, because that hits us in a practical term of whether or not it's the thing to go for. The technology is really exciting, so let's hope there is something to push for.
I just wanted to make a comment. I come to this as a string theorist, which is, you know, some about this optimism versus pessimism. Sometimes a few numbers really add a lot. You place them in the context of a more complete theory. Now, the fact is we don't understand string theory very well, and there's been some developments the past few years which suggest this landscape and the possibility that maybe you can get any number you want out of string theory. Now, that's very premature, I think, because we don't understand the theory well enough. And the fact is we live in a very special place with a very small cosmological constant. It could be, as we understand such vacua better, that there are very interesting correlations between the value of the cosmological constant and other parameters like R or NS and so on. And therefore, having these numbers, I think, might be very important in terms of both giving us greater confidence in that ultimate theory and perhaps also improving our then predictability from that theory for matters related to cosmology. So I feel, you know, just on that ground, given that we have the scope of improving our understanding of that fundamental theory much more for now, these numbers are actually important to get.
Right.
Just quick comment on your point, Dick. You know, we don't really understand what the issues are related to systematic errors from foregrounds in particular. We already see rather formidable ones from Planck, and we don't know what's lurking much below that. So I think politically it's hard for governments to justify specific missions. I mean, it's what you're seeing in the review panels, same thing, when they have to make hard choices. But at the moment, we're not really statistics limited or systematics limited, or will be shortly. And I think that's a large unknown at this point. So the question I have is really, if you had your choice of going after R versus non-Gaussianity, you know, where are you going to place your bets, given that you have finite amounts of money and finite ideas theoretically? And that I think is worth a discussion, because R is going to be pushed down, but at some point we'll hit limits which are going to be systematics. And in non-Gaussianity, we're already at that point of dealing with systematics. So, you know, where do we go next in terms of non-Gaussianity limits?
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I think one way or the other, a cosmic variance limited to all sky space experiment would be really good for non-Gaussianity constraints. No, I mean, in other words, the non-Gaussianity R can deliver great information, and it'll be fat. I mean, just think about that. But if you're, you know, just going to improve an upper limit, I would say that the bet on non-Gaussianity would be bigger, because you're going to get more cosmic information, high-quality bits out of the universe, because you're going to get structural information, not single numbers. Even though we tended to compress it into single numbers, it's actually you know, would be richer than that. I mean, it's like if the power spectrum has buried in there more radical breaking, so that it isn't just that NS constant, or if we can find that there is a robust, let's say, oscillatory feature, you really want to nail that thing, right? Because that's got a rich amount of new information. So it's really from an information content, from the theoretical perspective, that I think you would be trying to decide where the money should go. Because, if there's an inflationary story, R is there. It just might be really, really, really tiny. I mean, it's impossible to avoid, right? Because it's just gravity. So, you know, although for us, we're expressing it as a holy grail, it would be shocking if there weren't graviton fluctuations. And it's just a question of whether they're detectable.
Could we agree on go down past 0.01 and then switch to non-Gaussianity, if that's the choice?
Just time out for 2 seconds. If you leave the shuttle to the hotel, it is going to be leaving in about 2 minutes. They can shuttle some of you back, but they will not be able to shuttle all, the hotel will not be able to shuttle everybody. So you guys can talk as long as you want, but you may have to walk home.
Can you mention that there is a restaurant on the beach that offers happy hour to walk to as an option?
Yeah. How you get home from the restaurant, it's up to you. But the shuttle is out there looking to get back to the hotel the early sleep. You guys are welcome to stay at Marsden as long as you want. It's just we're contracted with them for a certain time. And the hotel will run in the hour and a half hour, but they only seat six in their van. They won't go back.
It is fortuitous that you are here at the point that you're here, because we haven't had a chance to thank the staff, and for you, it's actually the total is great. As usual, KITP puts on a magnificent performance for we scientists. Yeah. I must say, I wouldn't mind stopping at that, then I won't have to answer Eva. At what point, I mean, who knows, right? I mean, I want it to go down to 0.001. Maybe that would be a good boundary. 0.002 is not impossible from either, well, at least from what we know now, and we may, you know, hit a floor, but 0.002 is is forecasted for some ground or balloon experiments. So, you know, we could really break through the 0.01 psychological barrier here.
Is it a psychological barrier from a theorist point of view?
No, not really. No. They'll just change the floor.
No, it's not. It's not psychological.
It's like we did with the microwave background from the beginning, right? The target at one point was, what, 10 to the minus 3 or so, and then we dropped it by a factor of 20, and fortunately we didn't lose the experimentalists.
When people say they can detect 10 to the minus 2 in R, they really mean R detected, but they're not going to be able to tell you if it's scale invariant. And without knowing it, if it's scale invariant, you'll never be sure that you're actually seeing the thing you want to see. So once it's detected, you still need satellite. So if it's 10 to the minus 2, it's great, because now you can decompose them into harmonic series, and you can really see whether that's scale invariant. Then you're sure.
That no, you aren't.
Well, so you're more sure.
But it turns out,
yeah.
Even with
you get to do it at the Kobe level of power spectrum index, which is remember the Kobe numbers, it was like plus or minus point. Two-ish.
But it wasn't two.
No, that's a good thing to know, but you aren't going to get it at the kind of accuracy we're dealing with NS. Not even close. No, that's not enough of a lever arm. It really isn't.
Yeah, I'm not really talking.
That was actually in one of the figures that I had, and I'm sure you just completely absorbed it and saw that, you know, that's...
Yeah, terrible. Testing consistent relation is maybe... difficult, but I think...
Yeah, it is. But, I agree with you.
You need to...
I mean, after all, forget the inflation connection. If we think that we found primordial gravitational waves through looking at the microwave background, you just want to know everything about it, right?
Well, without knowing whether that's getting around, you'll never be actually sure that if it's gravitational waves. Right?
Yeah.
So...
It could be gravitational waves and not be scale. I mean, they're waves.
Yeah, absolutely.
Showing that a scale. And
I think what he's just saying is that you want to deconstruct it as much as you can.
Certainly.
So that it becomes R of K as much as you can, rather than just R at K pivot.
The 10 minus 3 level, I mean, that's we have indication that the polarization sky is tameable, right, from the foreground point of view. We can I do know things that you don't know, that's right. But I think that certainly from the instrumental point of view, this is not any more far-fetched than when we were proposing Planck, I mean, by any measure. On the other end, the old discussion there is that we know that the price tag for this, I mean, it's not going to be any cheaper than Planck. And so that's the question. We're back to what was said earlier, that is, you know, if you have a $1 billion in your pocket, what do you do with it? And so that's what you've been pressed to answer. And, you know, we got from Eva a pretty clear answer that it's 10 minus 2. This would be really great. It makes a difference. Okay, well. Others have been much more wishy-washy, at least that's the way I heard. And so I think this is it's a very practical question. I mean, some of us are actually involved in writing a case for such a satellite, which is due in 3 weeks. And, well. So. Well, damn it. Can't you tell them to wait another 5 minutes?
No, they've been here for 35 minutes.
All right.
No,
well.
Sorry.
No, that is, we have to cut short now. Yeah. I understand. All right. Well, you
heard me telling today. All right. Maybe happy hour.